So tonight, we are going to finish up this conversation on this general discussion around the Fourth Noble Truth. And I thought we would explore how do you just practice with these eight aspects of the Eightfold Path. So we're really going to just talk generally how you could practice with them. But I thought I'd go back a little bit just to make sure we're all on the same page and talk a little bit about what the Eightfold Path is again, just so we're all kind of understanding that it's eight factors. You can divide it up into three groups. A wisdom group, which has two factors in it, right view or right understanding and right intention. Sometimes it's called right thought or right aspiration. And then the middle group is around our ethical conduct or discipline. So it's right speech, right action, which is really the precepts, and right livelihood. And then there is the third grouping, which is around right concentration or concentration, and it's right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So basically these eight factors, you practice them and they lead to the cessation of suffering in the course of our practicing with them. So basically for the whole year, we're gonna talk about the whole Four Noble Truths. We've already covered this first noble truth, that there is suffering. We've covered this second noble truth, that there's an origin to that suffering. And we've covered the third noble truth, which is there's a cessation, that the cessation of suffering is possible. And then the fourth truth, which is where we're talking about generally, is the Eightfold Path. And it's the way that leads to this cessation of suffering. And then for the rest of the year, we're going to talk about each one of these factors. But I thought if we kind of have an understanding generally how we're going to practice with this, that it makes a little bit more sense when you try to practice each one of these factors one at a time. Because they can begin to lose context. So if you're practicing right speech, you can get so caught in considering and thinking about your speech that you forget that that speech is only one of the factors that's part of a path that is only 1/4 of this total kind of foundational Dhamma principles of the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths is one of Buddha's like foundational pieces. And practicing right speech is one aspect of it. Then just to make it really confusing, in case I haven't confused you at this point, each one of the truths, we practice each one of these truths in three ways. One, we recognize that the truth is there, so you're going to recognize that dukkha is present. Recognize the origin of that dukkha and recognize the cessation is possible of that dukkha, which is the Pali word for suffering. And then recognizing you see the aspects of the path, recognizing that. That's one aspect of all four of these truths. Second aspect is, you know, there's arises in you this wanting to understand. This wanting to understand suffering or dukkha, wanting to understand this origin of it, and wanting to understand how is it that this cessation is possible? What does that cessation look like? And wanting to understand each one of these aspects of the Eightfold Path. And then the third and final kind of I don't know what you call it, like the third element in each one of these truths would be that you actually, you feel inside yourself that you understand dukkha, you understand its nature, you've investigated, looked at it, and you understand it. You understand the origin of that dukkha or that suffering. You have seen and understood the cessation of the dukkha, and you've seen the application of the path, and you see this path. So that's a, ultimately, all of this is all tied into one thing. So one way to think about practicing in this general broad look is whatever we practice with over the next 8 months through this practice is somehow going to point you to the Four Noble Truths. Somehow, everything we do is going to point you some way to beginning to either see the presence of dukkha, see the origin, understand it, want to understand either dukkha, the origin, cessation, all of this. It's all kind of pointing towards this interconnectedness with the Four Noble Truths. So it's a little bit, it's a vast thing that we take on by looking at these things. But I think I've narrowed it, I like threes, so I narrowed it down to three things that I think in the backdrop, you could think of it as the backdrop, like when you're getting ready to take a picture and then they change the backdrop around the framing that you're going to take your picture in, or it's like the basket that holds everything in here. So I think there are three things that are the backdrop, sort of like if you point your attention towards these three things, then you can begin to see things that are going to help show you the path in a much more congruent way, show you these Four Noble Truths. So, you know, I think that the Eightfold Path, if on the last talk I gave on this, doesn't have anything to do with conduct. It has to do with beginning to see the energy or the conditioning that's pushing that conduct. That's kind of like the back energy around that conduct. And it takes something to turn your eyes off of conduct onto the energy or the push that's in front of that or behind it, making it happen. But that's what you're, everything in our lives seems like it forces us to want to look at the conduct and get that conduct right and don't pay attention about how it's there. But in the doing of that, we just keep doing the same habits over and over and over and wishing that we could do something different. So I think the path is pointing us to turn backwards and look at what's behind that conduct, what conditioning is there, what energy is there, what's pushing this happening. And the second thing, I think it's more of an inner journey, so it's more paying attention to what's going on with you rather than trying to fix the circumstances in your life so you can live a more peaceful life. If you can once again let go of the conditioning, let go of the circumstances out there, let go of what is right or wrong in my life, and just begin to turn inward to see what is going on with you, what's driving the dissatisfaction or the edginess, or if you, as my mother would say, wake up on the wrong side of the bed. I don't know which is the right side of the bed, but if you wake up on the wrong side of the bed, instead of going around trying your best not to be grumpy or, you know, just basically letting the world have it, instead, could you just turn and begin to sense into and feel what that energetic pool is that we call waking up on the wrong side of the bed. So it's this much more inner journey, I think. And then finally, I think you're actually looking for something that you don't already know. So you have to be willing to look for something that you may or may not even be able to see or understand at the time you start looking. Because if you understand it already, what's going to make you look? You figure you know it and you'll go about your business, won't even pay attention. So the whole point of the practice, following this path, is to get you to begin to look for something you don't already know in any given moment in time. So the three things that I think will help us do that is what I want to talk about tonight. The first is impermanence. Impermanence, impermanence, impermanence. Impermanence is so powerful, it's scary. If you go on a retreat, and in the beginning, you can't get yourself to stop thinking about the last conversation you had before you started that retreat. I'm just giving you a fair warning. If you're going on a retreat, a week before that retreat, make sure everything is pleasant, nice. Don't go around the people that are going to cause you a little disruption, because that is what you're going to be thinking about every day, all day, mind spinning, trying to fix that conversation you had. And you can't, because you're just sort of sitting there. So when you get about halfway into that retreat, you begin to notice how much you're holding on to something. You begin to notice that you're not just letting things float on by. You can feel into this understanding of what grasping is about, what holding is about. You can feel the body holding. You can just feel the kind of holding that's happening. And gradually, through that retreat, you begin to let go of that holding. And the only thing that we really notice is impermanence. We begin to notice that things come and go, rise and fall, here and there. And by the end of the retreat, we come home and say, oh my God, it was the best thing ever. It just was beautiful, and I was so blissful at the end. But what that feeling is letting life just be. Letting it be, not having to control, not having to fix and manage everything. And somehow, on a retreat, in these very controlled environments, we actually, as a yogi, as a practitioner, can learn how to do that. And then you practice that. You don't have to go on a week-long retreat or something like that. You can even do it at a non-residential. It's just the idea that you put yourself in a situation where there's extended practice, and you begin to stay in the noticing mode of watching what you're doing. And it doesn't take long, even in a non-residential. You know, by lunchtime, the mind is already grabbing hold of everything. And so you can tell that as the day goes on, you start letting things go. Sit after sit after sit, you begin to let this grasping go. And as you let it go, you get connected to this idea of impermanence. So the problem is that we can see that kind of impermanence when we are on retreat or doing some non-residential. You can begin to see that. But then when you just are walking around your everyday life, I'm going to move my hair because I don't know if that's what's causing that little poppy sound, but just in case. Oh, there you go. See, Jonathan's here, helping out. So in your everyday life, you're walking around, it's not so easy to see impermanence. We can see it when we're sitting in meditation and we're watching the breath and we're noticing how the breath comes and goes, and we notice sensations coming and going, and we get so acutely aware of that connection with it. But it's not just whether you can see impermanence on a retreat or in meditation so that you get these blissful, beautiful moments at the end of the retreat. Or, you know, after you've sat a while, you start getting these really, really nice experiences in sitting. If that was all there was, if that was the whole point, then I've been sitting a lot, and I should have plenty goodness going on in life, but it just doesn't work like that. So there's some other thing that we're kind of missing, and I think that is the looking for impermanence in our everyday life. So looking for impermanence in all these various situations. I'll give you an example. Every time we take a shower, brush our teeth, do whatever we do every morning, it seems so mundane and so habitual, we don't pay attention to the fact that we actually stop brushing our teeth at some point. We start and we stop. The tea that we drink or coffee we drink in the morning, that coffee is steadily moving down. It's steadily coming and going. Emotions, we feel one way as soon as we get out of the bed, and we never notice that that emotion or that mood or that attitude is somehow shifted. We might notice it if it shifts from a bad mood to a good mood, but more than likely we don't pay any attention to the fact that our moods are shifting all day long, that our attitudes are shifting all day long. We don't pay attention to the thousands of thoughts that come and go in our head all the time, the hearing of sounds here and there. It's all over the place. So when we're in these controlled environments, there's nothing else to do but begin to notice all of the grasping, and we can then begin to let go. But in our everyday life, it's not so easy to notice that, because there's plenty of things to distract us. And so, as we are looking at these eight factors, paying attention to the impermanent nature of everything, so the impermanent nature, or what I think of in Dhamma, everything is the same, whether you look at it as impermanent or permanent. So look at what you think in your life is permanent, where you think something is permanent. So even if you are, let's say, working with right view, looking at your opinions, looking at your perception on life, what is it that you think is permanent? And wherever that permanency is, that's where your suffering is going to lie, because soon enough, it will leave you, and you are going to suffer from it. Or soon enough, the very thing, you think I'm permanent, I've arrived, I'm retired, it's going to be all good now. No, something's going to come in there and change all of that. And then this idea of, I wish I was back at work. Or you think, oh, I finally got a job, now it's going to be good. And then you get to the job and, you know, 2 weeks in, you're like, oh, they got those kind of people here. Now you're going to have to work with that all the time. So it's sort of like beginning to see impermanence regardless of which factor you're working with. Another way to see impermanence, one of the ways that I begin to notice impermanence a lot, is from this idea that I'm holding something. And if you want to know if you're holding something, just pay attention to your fears, pay attention to your worries, your anxieties, your frustrations, your irritations. Those are all signs that you are holding on to something. So usually, if we weren't working on these eight factors, right, we would think, soon as you notice something you're worrying about, you try to fix it so you wouldn't be worrying anymore. But I'm going to suggest that you let those emotional things come up and you try not to get rid of them. At least long enough to take a moment to ask yourself, what is behind this worrying? What am I trying to hold on to or fix or control? Where's the impermanence in this? And would there be worry here if I was letting life, if I could see impermanence, would I be so worried? You just begin to question into whether or not these emotional energies are trying to tell us something in relation to the path. And then, of course, it doesn't matter, it's settled. I mean, this leads to the second one is, I think we have to look for kind of like the subtlety in things. We're not looking for so much the gross aspect of it. We're looking for the subtlety. So it's not just, oh, am I using right speech, right? Oh, I'm, you know, using good speech. But it doesn't matter whether your speech is right speech or wrong speech. Can you just notice the subtle energy that's behind that speech, whatever that speech is? Can you notice the subtle energies behind your conduct or what's happening when you think about your livelihood, when we talk about that, or even your practice, your effort? What's the subtle kind of pull or non-pull that's showing up in our practice? One thing that subtlety, a couple of things about subtlety. First of all, it's not in any kind of solution or answer. So if you're watching your behavior, watching yourself, and you begin to see that you are looking for some solution, some answer, as soon as I get it solved, the problem solved, then, you know, I'm not going to be quite so grumpy. Or I'm not going to be quite so irritated. That behavior, that idea that I can somehow or another right myself, or not right, but fix myself, correct myself, solve myself into the cessation of suffering, is not the suffering nor the cessation that the path is working with. The dukkha, or the suffering that the path is working with, is your own personal creation, and it usually is arising out of your holding on to something of some sort, some way, believing something shouldn't be or should be a certain way. To see that is a much more subtler way, because we have a hard time seeing our own disruption in things. We can see other people's disruption, but we don't really see our own disruption. I mean, because we're right? We're like trying to do the right thing, we're trying to be nice, trying to be kind. So turning inward and seeing our own creation of the difficulty in our lives, and not from a, oh yeah, I always mess up kind of attitude, but beginning to see it more as a habit, energetic conditioning that is holding something unnecessarily. That is a little bit more of a subtle level. So I used to tell myself, you know, I mean, I still tell myself, but I started telling myself, think of it like that, that I'm looking for a felt knowing, whatever that is, right? Somehow I feel like I should feel the knowing rather than intellectually know something. It needs to feel differently. And I know you guys know what I mean. Because everyone in this room has had what we call an aha moment. It's just this kind of knowing that shows up. It's like, and now I understand. It all makes sense. And it's not something that comes from the mind or the head or the thinking. It comes from almost like the body talks to us in a way that we understand. Oh, I see what it is that, oh, I understand something. So we're looking for that kind of felt knowing. And the only way to really get that felt knowing, I think, is you have to be still. You have to be quiet. You have to be still, you have to be quiet, and you have to wait. Just wait. So I'm trying to think to myself, how could I help you see what it is I'm talking about? So I think I came up with an analogy. You know how now the internet is pretty, you get on the internet, you type your little information in, check your website, and boom, there's a website. But get into a spot where the internet's slow. Then you're just like, poof. If you're like me, you're like, come on. You're making a mess. Because now, every time you hit and click that button to try to get the internet to go faster, you're like setting in motion the same page again and again and again and again and again and again. And then it's going to take forever for the page to ever come up. So that impulse to push, you have to sort of hold yourself back and wait for the page to come up. And those of us who have trained ourselves when the internet is slow to just wait a moment, let the page come up. Page comes up. In some respects, that's what we're trying to do. Much of what we're learning on the Eightfold Path, the mind can begin to understand and see. But we have to wait and give it time to begin to notice this kind of subtler level of looking. So it's in that being patient, being still, waiting a moment. If you're worried, you're like, okay, Tori said, I just need to just notice what I'm holding on to and let it go. So this idea that I'm just going to let it go. Then you're like poking, clicking, making a mess. Instead, think of it as that wait that we have to do to wait for the page to load. You can feel there's a bit of energy that says, come on, load already. But you still don't do anything. So when you're noticing that you're worrying and you're trying to see, what am I holding on to? You have to be tender and patient and wait in the midst of the tension that's coming around the worry without trying to make the worry go away. And be patient, be still, be quiet with that worrying or frustrating energy until the mind catches up. And you just don't know how long it's going to take before it catches up. You're not wallowing in the worry. You're just trying to give the mind and body a little space to catch up. And then the last thing is, oh, I know what I want. I love rhetorical questions. And so one way that I kind of help myself stay in this kind of waiting mode is I ask myself a lot of rhetorical questions. I don't really expect to get an answer, but I just keep saying it so that I can look for something. So some rhetorical questions you could ask is, in any moment, where's impermanence? So you won't necessarily see it, but if you ask that question and then get quiet and still, then eventually the mind-body connection will begin to show you impermanence. you could ask yourself, you know, am I holding on to an opinion or judgment right now? When you see yourself caught in something, am I holding on to something? Or just asking yourself, what are you holding on to right now? What are you trying to control? Things like that. So if you think about whatever aspect or whatever factor of the Eightfold Path we're in, you could ask yourself, what can whatever that factor is tell me about this moment? So what can right speech or what can right action or what can right effort tell me about this moment? You're just trying to ask into a rhetorical question that you don't know the answer to on purpose, because if you knew the answer, then the mind would just apply it. So instead, you're trying to ask into something that you don't know the answer to. And then that kind of forces us to have to wait until we get an answer on it. So the last thing I think will support us for the rest of the year when we're working with these factors is consider everything is Dhamma. Everything. Everything is Dhamma. If I watch movies, it's a Dhamma movie. If I'm watching Law and Order, this is a Dhamma episode. I know you didn't think about Dhamma in relation to the criminal justice system, but there's a lot of Dhamma in there. You know, I can see. It does kind of warp the whole TV thing, but if you were as addicted to TV as I was, you probably need that little bit of warping. But the idea is everything that happens to you for the rest of this year, bring it on the path. Bring it on and mull it around, contemplate, reflect upon it in relation to whatever that factor is we're working it with. Because it doesn't seem like this. But it's surprising to many people, they'll come up and they'll share with me, oh my God, we're talking about this. And then I notice this. I'm like, that's what Dhamma does. So when we come to these Dhamma talks and we listen and we start practicing and hearing, all kinds of things are going to come your way to show you the very thing you're inquiring into. That is sort of like the nature of Dhamma. But in order for you to begin to see it, you have to actually bring it onto the path and consider that nothing is going to happen to you. Nothing, whatever happens to you, it's meant to be. It's on the path. It has something to do with your greater awareness. It has something to do with your being able to see impermanence, the subtlety, the Four Noble Truths. And so everything becomes something to practice with. When we do the factors, we're just going to kind of like put a boundary around it or put a little net around it so you can focus in on something. But in the long run, whatever shows up, it's supposed to be there, and it's supposed to be there to help you on the path. One of the overarching thing I think that we begin to see when we start seeing everything as being on the path is this idea that nothing actually is me. Nothing is mine and nothing is myself. The selfing way that we go through life, when you start bringing Dhamma, seeing everything as Dhamma, part of the path, then what gets cut is this idea that, oh, this bad thing happened to me, or oh, this good thing happened to me, or this is mine, or this is not mine, because everything becomes this much more universal, much more natural flowing aspect of the path. You can't take ownership of it. So there's a couple of things there's a couple of suttas that I really like. We used them in the intensive class last year. I like them, so they're really out there in terms of, it's like, what is that kind of out there? But I think it's good to share them because it's going to spark this idea that I don't know something. But basically, in the first sutta, Buddha was teaching people this idea that nothing's yours. And so the whole point is to abandon whatever's not yours. So you might think, well, why would I consider abandoning my car or abandoning my house? We're all gonna like live out in the parking lot. But it's not really the abandoning the object, car or house. You're abandoning the your part of it. So you just have a car, you just have a house, and you take care of it and maintain it because you're living in it or you're driving it, but it's not yours per se. And the way he helped them see this is he asked a group of monks, you know, bhikkhus. He was basically telling them to abandon everything that's not yours. And he said, so bhikkhus, what do you think? Practitioners, what do you think? If people carried off the grass and the sticks, branches and leaves in this Jetta's grove, or burned them, or did whatever they liked with them, would you think people are carrying us off and burning us and doing what they like with us? Of course, the monks, they were like, no, venerable sir. He said, why not? Because that is neither, they said, why not? Because that is neither ourselves or what belongs to ourselves. And the Buddha said, so too, practitioners. Whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. So basically he's saying, if you abandon this idea, sort of like when I think of Sims and I think about our Zabutons and our Zafus and our furniture, our chairs, our things, this is Sims, this is ours. So if somebody were to come in and try to cart it off and take it away, we'd be like, no, that's ours. But we don't think of it as us. We don't think, oh, that's me, they're carting off. So the idea is to begin to abandon this idea that everything in your life is you or yours or yourself, that this is just a phenomena that happens to arise. So it's not your anger, your irritation. I'm mad, I'm worried, I'm anxious. It's beginning to see, oh, worry is present. And if you could see that worry is present, then you might also be able to see what's behind it. Because it's not you, and it's not yours, and it's not your old pattern, and this is what happens when I do this, and that happens, and this happens. Same old thing, I got it from my father, or whatever. You're not stuck in that, because it's just worry in general. And then you can begin to look at it. That might be understandable, not so weird. But the next one, it's a little bit more weird. So an old monk came to the Buddha and asked the Buddha to teach him the Dhamma in brief so that he, why does everybody want to know the Dhamma in brief? Just a couple of words. So that he could dwell and practice more diligent, ardent, and resolute. So the Buddha's thinking, oh my goodness, old man, you're advanced. He's been a monk a while. How am I going to teach you something? But the monk was like, please, sir, you know, tell me something. Help me understand. Do it in brief. So here's the Buddha's answer in brief. This is what he asked the old monk. Do you have any desire, lust, or affection? And he goes through all the different forms and things like that. So I'll just say, do you have anything, any desire, lust, or affection for anything that is cognized or seen by the eye that you have not seen and never saw before, that you have, that you do not see or would not think could be seen. So an easier way to say it, I rewrote it a little bit so it makes more sense, but he asked the monk, anything that the eye can see that are unseen to you, that you have never seen before, that you don't see, and that you, that are not seen by you, do you have any desire or aversion for it? So the point, the thing is, the eye sees it, but you don't see it. And it can't be seen by you, or it's never been seen by you. So you don't even know it's there. But the eye sees it, or the ear hears it, and all the sense doors, all those sense doors, the mouth tastes it, the nose smells it, the body feels it. But you, you don't see it, feel it, taste it, hear it. You can't taste it, feel it, see it, hear it. It's not even seen or felt or tasted or by you at all. So, do you have any kind of aversion or desire around those things? So the old monk says, no. I don't think I have any aversion or desire in anything that the eye may see, but I don't know it sees it. I don't think I have any desire. So the Buddha's response was basically, he says, so old monk, I'll read the, my kind of rewording it a little bit. With regards to phenomena that can be seen, heard, sensed, or thought about, in reference to that which is seen, there's only the seen. So whatever you see. He says, when for you there will only be seen in reference to what is actually seen, or only heard in reference to what is actually heard, or sensed in reference to what is actually sensed, then, old monk, there's no you in connection to that. And when there's no you in connection with that, there is no you there. And when there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. That's the end of stress. So, basically, what I think that is saying is that there's stuff that we don't see. We don't sense it with any of our senses. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but we don't sense it. And if I don't sense it, if I don't have a direct connection with it, it doesn't bother me. I don't have any aversion for it. I don't have any lust for it. I don't have any greed for it. I don't have it. So the thing that makes that greed, that lust, that aversion show up is when I somehow or another put myself in the mix. When I all of a sudden decide to look at things that I see or that, then I'm all caught up in it. So ultimately, I think we're looking for this kind of Dhamma in a way that we want to begin to see, either paying attention to the fact that there might be something here that I don't see, and beginning to see that the reason why we have this stress in the first place is somehow I've got some self attached to it. Somehow my mind, my thinking, my sense doors have got me glued to something, either as I don't like it or I do like it, and we want to see, can we see where that is? It's a little bit more of an edge. You have to sort of think about this. And I thought about it. Did I want to just leave it on that note? I thought, yep, that's the way I want to leave it. out there with this kind of like, what? Because if I leave it that way, you might mull over it a bit and mull over this idea that Buddha says that there are things that the eye or the sense door picks up, but we don't know it's there. We don't see it. We don't hear it. We don't smell it, taste it. We don't even think it. There are thoughts that we don't even think. Yeah, that's a little bit, isn't it? That's where we're going to leave it, right there. So we'll take a moment to just let the words kind of settle here. See, it wasn't until I actually settled down I heard that train thing whistle going. It was there, but I didn't hear it. Okay, let's see if there's any questions from anybody or comments or whatever of the sort. You can actually just share your comments about the practice generally if you want. I always wondered what people on the video think when they're just sort of sitting, like waiting. There's no sound. I feel like I should say something. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. No, I agree. So the comment was that when she feels this kind of tight energy in relation to the last thing I said about the selfing, letting go of the self, and you feel all tight and constricted, you know, something about that energy in the mind or in the body, you feel it. She thinks, oh, that's me selfing, that's me selfing, that's me selfing. And when she feels more spacious, there's a sense of there's less me attached to that. That's a really good example because I think what the Buddha was pointing in that last sutta is that if you begin to look outside yourself, there are things going on, happening that you may not necessarily be paying attention to. So you're basically creating some spaciousness around whatever that moment is. So an example would be that when I would have these anxiety attacks, and I'm trying to sit and meditate, and I'm in a panic state, then I would try to open my ears so wide that I could hear people talking in Portland. And just the idea that I'm trying to listen to hear people talking in Portland began to take the mind's energy off of just this excessive anxiety in the body. So you're adding much more that isn't necessarily present right then and there, or some other sense door. I try to see if I could feel sensations in my toes, Like, are there sensations there in the toes? Or is it just the sensation of this anxiety and the breathing and the, you know, blood flow and all of that? So that's what you're, I think that's what it's pointing to. Less about you and more about opening the sense doors up to way more than just whatever is like right there in front of you. There's a whole bunch more going on. So we have to see it and be willing to see it. So yeah, I think that's good. Oh yeah, good, thanks. Yes. So the comment is, could that last sutta I read also be pointing to the fact that we have this consciousness about things through the sense doors, and that the idea would be not to put the filter of a selfing or a me over the top of it? I agree. Same thing. It's the idea that you begin to see that everything that we're aware of, we're aware of it from this sense of me, from this sense of selfing energy. But trying to experience awareness that doesn't include me gets much more harder because we're only aware of the things that we're aware of. So I always use that sutta to tell me that there are things going on I'm not aware of. That there's a thing, there's something else going on that I just am not aware of. To begin to open up my capacity to accept in information that I can't currently see or know right now. And if we could begin to expand that out a little bit, then we can begin to open up to the possibility that cessation of suffering isn't going to come from fixing whatever I think is a problem. That it might come from something else. That the Four Noble Truths may not be about whether or not the conditions in my life are going good or not. That we could begin to see that it might have to do with something else. Ooh. Something other than what I can see right now. So I agree. It is that idea that because everything in my life is viewed through the prism of me and mine and myself, that is the thing that drives my entire opinion. But you could go one step further and begin to see that if you can see how much you are controlling or perceiving your life, what would it take to get you to consider that there might be a view other than yours, that there might be a... that you might could see stuff other than the thing you are currently looking at, this narrow view of some argument, and the mind is only paying attention to that argument over and over and over and over and over. So then, okay, listen to what the people are saying in Portland. You don't know. They may not even be talking about that kind of stuff. They might be all happy in Portland. So you just try to listen outside of just the thing that your mind is basically wrapped around in whatever moment it is. So I hope that adds to what you're saying. It's like taking it one step further so you can use this as a mechanism to practice with, to find a way to let go of that self. Otherwise, we are trapped in the self. Like, it's almost like that poem, you know, the idea that the birds, she heard this sound she's not used to hearing. Even though she lives her life, spent her life outside, she's never heard that sound. And that sound is what got her to look up and see the birds making that beautiful turn. We just love it when we see that the birds coming back and they're all turning together. It's so beautiful. And so, but we got to be looking for things we don't know, things we're not used to seeing or hearing or sensing. So I'm trusting we're all good. Either you're that or I really ended it on a really bad note. But I'm trusting that if you had a question or comment, you'd say it so we can kind of like move on. Oh, Gene.
I recognize that one of the biggest factors in my universe is the impermanence of my memory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's subtle. That you're looking for the subtle aspect. Oh, so let me just, for the video here. So the question was that trying to remember what are the three things I was talking about, and one of them being impermanence. But what I'm saying is that these are things you can pull upon at any time. At any practice, if you're trying to say, okay, I'm going to work with this right intention, but how do I work with right intention? Because Tim and I are going to talk about some practice ways with each one of these factors. But against all of that, there's always impermanence is always going to help you see the path, whatever that path is. If you look for the subtle aspect of it and not the grosser fixing the outer world, that's going to help you see into it. And if you take the self out, begin to see everything as Dharma. It doesn't have anything to do with you. Just whatever's showing up is showing up because it is the nature of Dharma to show up. And it's supposed to be on your path. That's why it's in your way, so that you can stop and take a look. So that's really what I'm saying, that whatever happens over the next 8 months, it's all good. It's all the way it should be. And that we're just going to practice with that, whatever it is. Okay? Good. We have some announcements.